From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Cyndi Lauper is best known for her pop hits, which include Girls Just Want to Have Fun and her work on the Tony-winning musical Kinky Boots. She recently returned to the studio to record a new album. It's a collection of country music covers called Detour. I sat down with Cyndi to talk about her music and her life and the things that have inspired her throughout the years. Here's our conversation.
Take me back to your childhood and when, where, and how you first fell in love with music. What are your first memories of this love affair that you've had all these years later with music?
Well, you know, when I was two, two and a half, which I remember quite clearly, I used to run upstairs to my godmother's mother. Her name, we were supposed to call her Senora, but my sister Ellen, whatever Ellen did, I did.
Yeah.
Because I was born after Ellen, and I was always told I was born to be Ellen's friend.
Yeah.
So wherever Ellen went, if she had a friend,
Cyndi would follow.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And if she went off and played with someone else, I would have a big fit because, let's face it, I was born to be her friend.
Yeah.
So she had to play with me,
right.
You know. And of course, it was always a matter of trying to ditch me, you know, because I was very persistent. And so when she wasn't around, I'd go upstairs to Senora, who we called Senuda, which kind of means you're nude in Sicilian, but nobody really paid attention because we were just kids,
right.
You know. It got weird when we were 12 and we were calling her Senuda.
Senuda, yeah.
You know, and then Sitzi.
Uh-huh.
Sitzi Paulie was her husband, and they lived upstairs, and it was really supposed to be Sitzi, but we couldn't pronounce that either, so we called him Titsy.
Yeah.
Which was okay as kids, but when we got to be 12, that was weird.
Yeah.
But she taught me, how to sing. She had her hands up like this, and I held onto her hands, and it was kind of like bouncy, bouncy, and it was just, you know, Bella, Bella, you know, just something.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would perform that for whoever she wanted, you know. Mm-hmm. She'd go, oh, look at this, and I would sing what she taught me.
Yeah.
And then from there, I was just always curious, and I played alone a lot.
'Cause you kept getting ditched.
Well, I did get ditched, but I was also like a scientist. It was almost like I was a mad scientist because I would, you know, investigate everything. And then when I was old enough to play records, of course, you know, I started listening to my mom's recordings, and it was all her Broadway shows. And of course, The King and I was like, oh, that was really big, you know. So I played that over and over again. One time my grandmother came from upstairs, that's after we moved to Queens from Williamsburg, and she came down and she didn't say anything. She just took the record off of the record player, my little red record player, and went upstairs and said nothing. Because I played it so many times, I think she was going to have a nervous breakdown.
So Broadway was in your destiny?
I didn't know.
Yeah, from childhood.
Well, but that's how I played. I would change my voices and be the different people. I entertained myself a lot.
Yeah.
I was Rex Harrison sometimes, but yet other times I was Julie Andrews, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was Richard Burton, too. I was a lot of people, you know. And, you know, I just, that's how I learned to change my voice. And then when I was 9, my cousin Linda got me a Christmas present, 2 albums. One was Meet the Supremes and Meet the Beatles. So I met them, and I really loved them. And then after that, they were my friends.
Yeah.
You know.
Tell me about your mother.
What about her?
Anything.
Well, she's happy now. She's in Florida with my brother. Most of my family moved to Florida. You know, for Italians, it's kind of like the tri-state area, but they don't realize it because, you know, they come to New York. Mm-hmm. My family went to Brooklyn. Half of them went to Staten Island, to New Jersey, right, and then to Florida. And then the others went to Queens, to Long Island, and then to Florida.
But they all end up in Florida at some point.
Well, yeah, it was the tri-state area.
Yeah, tri-state area. I get it, yeah.
So, you know, so she's happy. But, you know, I'm just lucky. I got to play with my mom twice in my life.
Yeah.
I played with her when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was really small, because I used to hang on her legs, and it was the 50s, so they had the can-cans mm-hmm. and the wide skirts. Mm-hmm. And I used to feel like I was in a Ferris wheel, just hang on her legs while she was washing the dishes or something, you know. And then, you know, we played together, and then afterwards, when I was an adult, she was in my videos. She was in Girls. She was in Shebop. Oh, my God. Shebop had my mom, Aunt Gracie, Aunt Helen, and Aunt Big May. My yeah. mom was Middle May. Mm-hmm. In my family, they named people three times. After yeah. that, they let go, you know. It was like Big May, Little May, Middle May, and Little May.
Yeah.
And then after that, they go to a different name.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of Franks.
Yeah.
A lot of Franks.
So they're Cindy's? Yeah.
Only no, it was the other generation.
Other generation, yes. Yeah. So just yeah. you stopped that tradition.
I did. Yeah, I changed yeah. the spelling, too.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm listening to you talk about these humble beginnings and how you fell in love with music and how this love affair began.
I didn't think it was humble. I thought it was fantastic.
Tell me more then. Yeah.
Because they were so colorful. Williamsburg, when I was little,
yeah.
there was all different kinds of people. They were all different. There was the Spanish people mm-hmm. and how the women dressed. And they were a lot like Italians, the mm-hmm. way they dressed. And then Snooter would walk us over. Well, she walked me because I was always hanging with her. Mm-hmm. We'd go to the Hasidic section, mm-hmm. which was very exotic, mm-hmm. really exotic. Well, the outfits.
I know.
You know.
I just never thought of Hasidics as exotic, but I take your point.
But, you yeah. know, I felt bad for the women because they didn't get all the cool the clothes. Mm-hmm. Like the guys had the cool clothes, the hats.
Exactly.
Come on, the yeah. hats oh, alone,
yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah. oh,
and then
yeah.
later that became kind of a punk look mm-hmm. with the white socks and the hats and the overcoats, yeah. you know, with the shoes. Come on.
Yeah.
It was fashion everywhere I looked. And right across the street was the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Mm. So out my window, I would watch these outfits, you know, white with black buttons
yeah.
or black with white. Very French, I thought. You
yeah.
know, kind of French. No. Then I went to Catholic school in Queens, and that was a lot of black
yeah.
with white. Also French.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand how come the guys wore a more comfortable outfit and the women were kind of like choked and, you know. I thought that was like a little unfair.
You've been observant.
I'm a scientist.
Life, your whole life. You're a mad scientist.
Yeah. I think so. Not mad.
You, yeah. Just scientist. Not mad. Just,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm not angry anymore. Maybe I was then.
Yeah. How do you process then? I was starting to say from those humble beginnings, and you back me up on that, and I take your point. But from those beginnings, how do you process the wild success that you have had? I knew this, but I got reminded of it in reading my research and preparing for our conversation. You are three quarters, as I mentioned earlier, you are three quarters of the way to what we call an EGOT. Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony. The only thing missing for you is the O.
That's right. I got to get one.
Yeah.
I got to write a beautiful song.
But how do you process this success that you have had over the course of this career?
Well, one, I'm never going to give up. You know, when you first hit, mm-hmm. you know, it's such a road to get
yeah.
to square one where you actually are successful. And it's kind of like winning the lottery.
Right.
I guess I won the lottery, you know.
I'd say so.
Yeah. And it depends on the work you want to put in. In the beginning, I played in cover bands and I was like, you know, but if I didn't do that, I would have never learned how to perform. My first gig in a cover band as a lead singer, because I had big dreams of being a background singer.
Right.
But I used to fall a lot. And when the show was going down, they'd have me come and sing lead, and then they'd get the people going, and then I'd go back and try and dance and sing with my friend. You know, she was Chip, I was Dale, and was trying to,
yeah.
had the platforms, my ankles are skinny, you know.
Yeah.
I've been working on that ever since,
yeah.
you know. But, and if it wasn't for those performing gigs, you know, my first gig I sang in front of 10,000 people in Bordy Barn, like a big old place in the Hamptons where people just came like a beer fest or mm-hmm. something, I don't know. and in the summer, and I was just singing, and I learned how to perform. You know, there were big clubs, there were like little clubs. And when I came out with She's So Unusual, my first gig was for 14 people in, where was it? The Last Chance, in The Chance, it's now called, but it was The Last Chance, which was called The Last Chance because it was vaudeville place. And when I was in Blue Angel, the rockabilly band I was in, we played there, and it wasn't so empty. But now, all of a sudden, here I was starting out again, which I didn't care. And what I had remembered from all of those other times was that in performance, really, you are an alchemist. It's where you go when you're singing. See, it's where you stand, and you have to anchor your feet into the ground somehow, even though I was always moving. And somehow there's a line that goes up and down to the core of the earth, through you, all the way up and down. And in the right rhythm, in the right key, and the right words, you can literally escape from here. It's an otherworldly experience that I learned from playing those clubs, good and bad. It was the good, the bad, and the ugly. We played all kinds of clubs. Some days were great, some days weren't, doing all the covers. And I learned that in the heart of the song, there is a place to go. And if I can go there, when it took a while to learn that I could go there, well, in performance, when you once you get there and you're escaping, somehow you can teach, you can bring everybody with you. And so when I played that club, which to me was filled with the spirits of all the hopeful people who were doing vaudeville, coming, you know, one more chance to get it together before Broadway or wherever they, because Broadway was filled with vaudeville then. And I would feel the spirit, and I would, I looked at the 14 people and I went, oh yeah, it's gonna be fun. And then I thought to myself, no, in my mind, I'm gonna play this and it's gonna become Madison Square Garden. And all these people, they're gonna come with me. And that's what I did. And I did the encore. But the owner was a riot. The owner came back and he looked at me and he said, you know, you were really something. But now when you brought out that ukulele, I was worried about you, but you really turned it around.
I sat quiet because I was following you into this place. And you make this place that you find sound so sublime and so joyful and so spiritual. My question is that a high that you're always chasing? Do you find that consistently in that moment, or?
Oh yeah, you always chase it because once you get it, then you're addicted.
Yeah.
And I think, I always thought that's what Dylan's Knocking on Heaven's Door was about. I mean, I don't always understand all his diction, but you know, the hooks I got, you know, that was a hook. But I thought it is a portal, and sometimes they let you in, and sometimes you're just struggling on the outside trying to get in, and you have to remember, let it go, hear the rhythm. Like one time, well, I gotta say, when I did the Memphis Blues album, that was like the most extraordinary thing.
Because the blues can do that to you.
Well, it was extraordinary. And that's why when I wanted to do this album, they kind of go hand in hand, because the time period is when rock and roll began, which was, you know, Wanda Jackson and Elvis and all these, and Jerry Lee and Chuck Berry, and they were kind of doing rockabilly turned a little, you know, they were doing country and blues mixed. And that's the beginning of what I sang for the rest of my life, which is rock and roll. So I was always looking for the portal. The strange thing is that you don't always get it. Sometimes you have to just listen to the sound, and then you ride the wave. Once you have the sound and you hear, you fall into the center of the rhythm. It's interior rhythm. And once you have that, then everything is around you. Most musicians, they don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. They kind of think, you know, it's around them, which, you know. But for me as a singer, because when I was in the cover bands, I was bored with my voice. I thought, gosh, I'll never sound as good as, you know, Rod Stewart. I used to sit in the shower trying to squeeze my throat together, make that sound, you know. And I'll never sound like a guy, you know. So I would pass the guitar players, the really better guitar players from the cover bands. They studied. And they studied, you know, I passed a guy, Billy. He was a friend of mine. His name was Billy. And I asked him about it. And I said, you know, well, I see you study. Who do you study with? And he said, well, I study with Lenny Tristano, School of Jazz. So I looked at him. I said, well, do they trade in singers? And he said, I'm sure they do. So he gave me a number. I called. And I wound up studying with Betty Scott, who was Lenny Tristano's vocalist. And I guess later on I found out his wife. I didn't know, you know. And I studied Billie Holiday. I mean, she was obsessed with it to the point where she told us to breathe with her, learn the phrasing, and I started to do that. And it started to become my mother voice, you know? And I just kind of fell into the rhythm. Although I knew it wasn't good, I didn't want to sound like her, but I learned the rhythm. And then she told me I had to learn the rhythm of Lesty Young's saxophone.
The Prez, yeah.
So that I learned the what they're doing together and the space between them and how the, and the rhythm of it. And all of a sudden, instead of being afraid of the drums, because I had to keep up with it and be, you know, and, you know, I realized there's the center of the drums. And then my whole idea about singing changed completely because I wasn't afraid anymore of not getting it or this or that or coming in on time or, you know, I was in the center of the rhythm and the idea of the center of the rhythm. And that's how I arranged the whole She's So Unusual record with these wonderful, magical, unsuspecting fellows that I worked with on She's So Unusual. I still work with William Whitman, and I work with Rob and Eric. I worked with them through my life, but I'm going to work with Rob again. We're going to do some more stuff together. But it's all about the rhythm. And I started to tell you about the blues record because when I went to South America the first time, I was doing dance music, easy peasy, because they love dance, right? Everything's about dancing, and it's fantastic. And then I'm going, okay, now I'm coming with the blues album. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, that's going to be good. It's a totally different thing. But then I started to think, well, it's all about the rhythm. And I remembered listening to Arthur Turner and his Fife Band. And Arthur Turner, it sounded, those drums sounded like the carnival drums, which makes perfect sense because the carnival came from Bahia, and Bahia is only, what, 60 miles or a little more to Africa, you know? And so, of course, the music came. And so I started to think, okay, you take those carnival drums, you put them in the center of a blues shuffle, and you have some magical rhythm. So every night when we played there, I would take a little alcohol and spill it on the front of the stage for the spirits, because in Brazil, there is a lot of spirit. Mm-hmm. And one time when I was singing, I actually saw in my mind someone who was, I don't know, a king or a priest, but native. Mm-hmm. And he said to me that the conquistadors came and they conquered, but they could not conquer the rhythm. And in the rhythm is real freedom. And then that opened my heart and my mind open even more. And there were so many out-of-body moments when I sang because they gave it up. And we all gave it up. But that's inherent in the blues. When I went to do the country music, I tried to do the same thing, but it wasn't, it's not, like, the blues is all about that. But country music is also very soulful, but you can't get in the same way. I wanted to make sure that, again, I went straight for the rhythm, mm-hmm. even though they are rhythmic, these songs are rhythmic, but it's kind of tricky. It's not as obvious and overt, you know. In my mind, no matter, like, even in the blues songs, I always saw, there was a lot of, I don't know, when I close my eyes, I see a lot of people and a lot of things. And whatever spirit comes, I write it and I sing it. I don't ask. I'm just grateful to go along for the ride, you know? Mm-hmm. But with this music, still, you know, part of it was, there was like a stripper lady walking along. And as long as it was like, dun, 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 you know, it's always in there somehow. Mm-hmm. It's sexual, you know? And I kept saying that to the drummer, and I was lucky enough to have a wonderful bass player also, not just Chad, but the bass player was Willie Weeks, mm-hmm. who I guess originally was from Memphis. And it was kind of an extraordinary rhythm section, but they played together all the time, all the time. Mm-hmm. So they do one thing after the other after the other. And the first song I sang, I sucked. I couldn't connect. They connected, but I was the outsider. And I'm thinking, oh, God, you know. And the producer, Tony Brown's gone, no, Sin, I don't know. You're so much better than that song. Why you like that song? You know, but it was the story. It was a Marty Robbins song, mm-hmm. Begging. I liked the story because it reminded me of the people that I knew when growing up. I was so privileged to see real people. It was very Shakespearean, some of it tragic, some of it ridiculous, some of it very funny, you know. And this song reminded me of that, but it didn't work, not right away, so we put it aside. Then there was another song, didn't work. Then we get to End of the World.
Why does the sun go on shining? Why does the sea rush to shore? Don't they know it's the end of the world if you don't love me anymore?
Which is kind of like a pop song. It was a pop song, but I didn't know it was a country song. I thought it was Hermits. I was young. And so they started playing it, and, you know, Tony wanted to get rid of that Farfisa sound because he thought that was very dated. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I was like, okay, and he wanted to use a synthesizer, and I brought up the fact that maybe we should use a Prophet keyboard sound. For those who don't know what that is, the Prophet sound was very much a part of the 80s. It's a warm sound on the keyboard that kind of sounds a little translucent, but it's an analog warm sound. It's on Time After Time, mm-hmm. you know. So I used a lot of it, and I knew that if I used that, it's a transparent sound, won't eat up a lot of space, have room for everything else. And there's a sound in my voice that I could make that's kind of you know, it has air. Mm-hmm. It kind of could sound like that complement, that keyboard. So we start the song, and I know the story. And all of a sudden, I get on the air, that sound, and I'm following the keyboard. And all of a sudden, I just kept staying. I knew I couldn't deviate from that sound one inch. I had to just ride that wave, and it became a wave of sound. And at that moment, it became otherworldly, because it was the sound that you rode. Mm-hmm. And you can't move from it, and you can't think. Once you start thinking, gone, over. It's almost like, you know, when you do an acting gig. I'm not the actor of the family. The actor of the family is really my husband, and who knows, maybe my son one day, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the great ones, like I worked with Christopher Walken one time, and he works like a musician. You know, he rides the wave. Whatever happens, he doesn't stop, he just does it. Mm-hmm. Which I found really kind of inspiring, you know? It's a lot like music. It was, you can't move an inch, you can't think, you just stay with it and don't change a thing. Just tell that story with that air and with that sound and ride it to the end. And that's what we did. And when we stopped, we all looked at each other and said, wow, what just happened to us? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, that became the bar. And everything else was, you know, just, yeah. You could have anybody. That and the Wanda Jackson song, Funnel of Love. And that was a rhythmic thing. Mm-hmm. I knew that rhythm from Blue Angel, because yeah. I listened to her, because none of the male rockers I could ever sound like. But when I heard a familiar female voice doing rock and roll, I was like, yeah, women rock, you know. And so when I got this song, I forgot all about my days until I started listening to the rhythm. Yeah. Again, it was the rhythm, but yeah. It's subtle. It's not as obvious and overt as it is in the blues.
The thing I've always loved about country is, and this is what turned Ray Charles on about it, is that it, to your point, tells a story. There is no music, I think, that tells better. I'm a lyric guy, I love lyrics.
Yeah.
There's no music that tells a better story than country music. And I think if you can make all that other stuff work, which you obviously made work, the story is there.
Yeah, it was
a great story. It's how you communicate that, how you get it across, and you mastered that. I want to go back, though, as I said a moment ago, to have you unpack for me this comment you made about finding freedom in the rhythm. That thing hit me pretty viscerally, and I think I know why, but I wonder if you just speak more about that notion of freedom being found.
As a scientist?
As a scientist. Okay. Not a mad scientist, just a scientist.
Right, because I'm not angry anymore.
I learned that last night. Okay. Explain that for me.
Get Lisa, no. Yeah. I think that because everything about us humans is a rhythm. Mm-hmm. We got a pulse, that's a rhythm. Mm-hmm. We got a heartbeat,
that's a rhythm. Yeah.
We got brain waves, that's a rhythm. Everything about us is a rhythm. So that's why when I saw that guy, it was just another voice telling me, the same way that Billie Holiday's voice told me, it's in the rhythm. And, you know, I listened to Louis Armstrong and Fats Waller when I was little. Mm-hmm. I loved it. We danced wildly to that. But we had a lot of other things. She played a lot of Puccini, mm-hmm. which is beautiful, but as you know, it never goes well for the woman. Not in those stories. So... you know, though my grandmother was very disappointed that I wasn't an opera singer.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. You could have been, though.
No.
You don't think so?
The nuns thought so.
Yeah.
And they talked to my mother, my poor mother. You know, she got divorced when we were kids, and then she was trying to help us. And my grandfather was kind of trying to make it a little more difficult so she'd go back to my father, but it was never going to happen.
Yeah.
And so, but it wasn't like they were doing it maliciously. They thought they were trying to help. And they were always there, you know. But, she, you know, we went to a convent school because they got thrown out of the first grade school, you know, Catholic school, because when I went to confession, the priest said, you know, what are your sins? And I didn't go to Mass, and he told me I was going to go to hell like my mother. And I took issue with that. And I said, excuse me, you don't even know my mother. She's a good woman. She works hard for her kids. She loves us. And how do you know she's going to go to hell? And basically, I almost said, you should go to hell, but I didn't because I knew that would be disrespectful.
But you got close enough to get kicked out anyway.
Well, what they did was, you know, political differences.
Yeah,
I was eight.
I get it.
All right? And I felt strongly that that was the wrong thing to say.
About your mama. Yeah.
That's right.
I got it.
So then I went to the convent school, and I had more political differences there. But they used to get us up very, very, very early. You know, to make the beds and get everything sorted so you can get to Mass and communion or whatever it was you were going to have and then get to breakfast and get to school. So I just thought that God was a very early riser.
Yeah.
You know, and I would get nauseous every time because I wasn't an early riser. But I figured, well, God is, so may as well, you know, do the same thing.
Yeah.
But they were not, really not into me because, you know, but I could sing.
Yeah.
I would sing for them all the time.
That made them happy.
Well, then they said, they told my mother I should be trained as an opera singer or something.
Did you rebel against that? Why did you not take that seriously?
Well, because we didn't have money for that.
Yeah.
And my mother was with me one day crying that she couldn't, you know, do for me what I needed to do to become the success I should be. And she's ready to, you know, adopt me off to a rich family. And I was like, wait a minute. What are you talking about here? That's not important to me. We're important, you know. And so, thank goodness she listened, you know. But, yeah, we were thrown out of that school, too. I asked the wrong questions. Yeah.
Sometimes in life you do that. You ask the wrong questions.
Well, I'm not a big on the mysteries.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
There's too many, you know. All right. You know, because I'm a scientist.
Yeah, yeah. I said to somebody on this show not too long ago that I am thoroughly convinced as I get older that part of navigating life successfully is coming to a place where you accept that you are going to have to live your life with some unanswered questions.
Really?
That's for me.
Oh.
That's for me.
I want to know.
Everything?
Not everything. The things I need to know to move forward.
Yeah.
And then when somebody's in front of me going,
yeah,
you know, and they say detour.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, well, some detours are good detours.
Mm-hmm.
So let's find out what's there. And I learned in my life that even if you start out with a group of people, and you think you're going to take their path, like everybody's going to be, they're not, and you're not. And my path has been so dramatically different from everybody I started out with. I always felt like, well, you don't have the same success because maybe you're not as good or you're not a good business person or blah, 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 you know. But then along came Harvey Fierstein, who I really, really admired. And, you know, we became, you know, we talked a lot because I had this other idea I wanted to do about my family on Broadway. And I didn't want another writer. I wanted to write with him. But he was doing Hairspray. So he called me one day. I had done a punishment tour back in, it wasn't really a punishment tour. It was kind of like that because, you know, you travel through Europe. It's a double-decker bus. You know, you're the star. So they put you in the back, you know. And I was in the back, and I felt like, you know, a bushel of vegetables in a truck flying from one side to the other. And, you know, or like a Lucille Ball episode. You know, every time I try to make the bed, I'd be flung on this side and that side. And then the bus drivers tell me, well, you know, Stevie Wonder was in the back. And I'm thinking, How did he manage? Then I used to walk around and I found Velcro all over the place. And I started to think, oh my God, what'd he do? Velcro himself in like David Letterman? It was like, it was weird, you know. But I knew where his keyboards went because they had Velcro right there. Mm-hmm. You know, anyway, that's, I digress.
When you, since you digress, I'll jump in here. Looking back, I think it's probably the only way to ask the question. When you look back at The Unusual Project, what do you make of it? How did that fundamentally change your life, your world view? I don't want to color the question too much, but take me back to that project and the wild success that we all know that project spun off for you. What do you see in retrospect when you think about that project?
Well, you know, when we were doing it, we knew it was special and we hoped for that kind of success. But when Girls Just Want to Have Fun came out, it only got like 5 ads a week or 2 ads a week on the radio. So everybody was looking at us going, I don't think so. I think we ought to go with that ballad of yours. And I was like, nope. If we go with the ballad, we're going to be stuck with the ballad and you'll never be able to come with an up-tempo song. You got to come with an up-tempo song first and succeed. Then you can come with anything. Then you come with the ballad and you got the 1-2 punch. Because I saw what they did with all the other groups that I worked with and how they got derailed because of it. So Dave Wolf, who was my manager at the time, he looked at me and he said, I said, so what are we doing? And he said, I have an idea. And he was an avid wrestling fan, as was my grandfather. And so I had met Captain Lou Albano on a plane. I had an idea for Blue Angel to do like a cuckoo commercial with a funny voice, you know. At first, I wanted Tom Carvel to do it, but he wasn't doing anything but Carvel commercials. So I thought it'd be funny if it was like, Blue Angel, look at what we have here. What a great record. You know, because that would make you listen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's nutty.
Right.
And so when I met Captain Lou, I thought, well, he's nuttier and he's funny. And Girls Just Want to Have Fun, the video came up, and I was struggling with everybody because I wanted a group of, he said, we're going to have a group of girls. And I said, well, if we're going to have a group of girls, we're going to have a group of girls of all color so that we have a rainbow tribe in here so that every little girl who looks at that video can see herself and know that she too is entitled to a joyful experience in life, not braces on the brain, which is what I saw in my whole life and so many women derailed constantly. So I decided, and these were fabulous women too, kind of really fabulous. They had a sense of fashion and life, and you know, just on my block, one woman dressed like Diane Baker, the other one looked, my aunt looked like Polly Bergen, my mother dressed like Susan Haywood. It was very glamorous, you know. And I thought, well, when we do this video, we have to have all different kinds of faces, and it's gonna be great that way. And they were like, send it, you know, like I'm a pain in the butt. And I was like, it's okay, I'm a pain in the butt. But Ed Griles, the director, was so giving and so great about it, and we brought all these people together, and he suggested Gorgeous George to be the dad. And I said, no, I just met somebody who'd make a perfect dad, crazy as a loon. It's Captain Lou Albano. And then we couldn't get a woman to play the mother, and of course we had no money, so I went to my mom, and I said, look, Ma, we could do this together. I don't have any money to pay you. She said, don't be ridiculous. And I said, okay. I said, but I also want you to think about what it would mean to be with your real mom and portray that on television. It might bring mothers and daughters closer. Because right now, but at that time, it was kind of cool to diss your mom. And the truth is, you're not going to get along with your parents as you're a teenager, but you should always know your family history. Because if you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you're going to go, and you make a lot of mistakes that way. So I thought it'd be good to keep it in the family. And then I realized it's kind of all those videos in the beginning, they were all photo albums of all my friends at the time and my family. My brother Butch is in there, my mom's in there, Dave Wolf is in there, my dear friends are in there. People I knew from the hair dressing thing, all the hairdressers and the clothing people, the people from Screaming Mimi's. It was kind of a great, great moment. Whether it was going to be successful, we had no idea until we started doing wrestling.
Yeah.
His idea was go into wrestling, then I became a wrestling manager, you know. I'm telling you.
It worked out. It's a great video. And I cannot end this conversation without asking you to say something, whatever, about the song that for many of us has been just an anthem all these years, time after time.
Oh, well, I was arguing with them because I'd become a good arranger. We'd all become good arrangers. And they had this other song they wanted me to sing, but I wanted to write one. So I kept struggling. I want to write. So we finally get to write Time After Time. And I didn't even know what I was going to call it. I looked in the TV guide. I said, oh, here's a title, Time After Time. Just use it, replace it. And then when it came time to try and replace it, I couldn't take it out. Every time I took it out, the song fell apart. So I was thinking, oh, for crying out loud, really? And then I looked up how many songs were named Time After Time, because it was taken from a movie. And I thought, oh my God. But there's a lot of songs called Time After Time, so it all worked out. And I guess when I was writing it, I was a little off. And then I kind of felt a hand on my shoulder that just said, just write it and let go of all that. And that's when I just finished the chorus, you know, on the phone with Rob. And
I told you earlier, I love lyrics. And when you really listen and pay attention to those lyrics, it's a powerful piece of work.
Well, you know, lying in my bed, I hear the clock tick and think of you.
Yeah.
When I was living with Dave Wolf, I had a loft bed.
Yeah.
And I had got this little Betty Boop clock for my birthday or a present. Mm-hmm. And when he climbed up the loft one day, he dropped the clock and it fell on the floor and smashed in little pieces. And he went to his mom's and he got this other clock for me. And it was so loud, I put in the bathroom, in the tub, closed the shower curtain and the door, and I'd climb up on that and still hear the clock tick.
Yeah.
So that's the line, lying in my bed, I hear the clock tick and think of you. That's where it came from. I mean, a lot of this stuff came from life.
Yeah, that's what makes it work, though. It's the life stuff that makes it work. I have enjoyed immensely being able to get inside the head of one Cyndi Lauper.
Well, I know I sidetracked a little
bit. No, it was. I loved every minute of it. The new project, the latest project from Ms. Lauper, is called Detour. Thank you for allowing me to sit here and just revel
in
your
brilliance. I'm a big fan of your show.
And thank you.
You're welcome. And if Kinky Boots comes back and you want to see it, it goes through your town.
I'll call you.
No, definitely we want you to see it. It's a fun show. It makes people happy.
I got a new friend named Cyndi Lauper.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsiabwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.